on ABC Local Radio, Radio Australia and the World Wide Web. This is Sunday Nights with John Cleary.
Hello there and thanks for joining us on this ABC Radio special. Yes, it's Olympics and we're broadcasting on digital and live streaming on the web on Sunday nights. Coming up in this hour shortly, we're going to meet Australian flautist Jane Rutter. Following Jane, Noel Debien will be along to talk about Ramadan, this time from the point of view of Somalis who endured a terrible drought last year, and reflecting on how they coped. Then Mark Juergensmeyer, Professor of Sociology and Director of Global and International Studies at UCLA, Santa Barbara, University of California, will be along with Andrew West to talk about the continuing strife in Syria. Then a little musical relief. It's the centenary of one of America's genuine musical greats, a troubadour of the poor, Woody Guthrie. And it's a bit of a coincidence, I guess, that this year is Charles Dickens' bicentennial, the great novelist of the poor, the problems of the poor in England in the 19th century, and Woody Guthrie, a troubadour of the 20th century. We'll spend some time with the music of Woody Guthrie and then round out the night with Dr. Stuart Edser, talking about the continuing issue of homosexuality in society and the attitudes to gay marriage and other things. Rather topical. So on Sunday night, let me introduce Rachel Conn of Radio National's The Spirit of Things. And this evening she's taking us on the second of the journeys into a spiritual diary. Rachel Conn requested a number of people to keep spiritual diaries for a month. And this evening, flautist Jane Rutter.
I've been asked to write a spiritual diary. After my first reaction, one of delight that I would be asked to contribute to one of my favourite radio programs, my immediate impulse was to get myself into nature. I cannot possibly write a spiritual diary without nature and its surrounds.
Jane Rutter is Australia's premier flautist. Hello, I'm Rachel Conn, and Jane's my guest on the Spirit of Things monthly series, My Spiritual Diary. Jane Rutter is one of the most versatile and busy Australian musicians. Sydney-born and educated at the Conservatorium, she's performed across Australia on stage and on screen, and around the world to great acclaim. A classically trained flautist, she easily and successfully glides into jazz and popular music. She's a composer, including of the music you just heard from Titania's Dream. She's a storyteller and chanteuse, and has recently written and produced the one-woman show An Australian in Paris, about her days as a student learning the flute from Alain Merion and Jean-Pierre Rampal in the city of Bohemian Love. So what gives this female Pan her drive, her vision, her care and love for life, the planet, and above all, her music? Sit back and enjoy the adventure into Jane Rutter's spiritual diary, which begins in nature, and here she explains why.
It's tender indifference, the smell and taste of it. The way the molecules in my body respond to the molecules in the atmosphere. The air's not the same inside. I need to be in the cathedral of the outdoors, air for inspiration, leaves for my blanket. I need the purity of nature in order to be spiritually in touch and spiritually communicative. I wonder how many others feel this way. When I reflect further on this need for a religious-style connection with the natural world, in fact, being a musician entirely devoted to my work requires a form of mysticism and in many ways an almost monastic discipline. Fine music creates in human beings a connection on four main levels: emotional, intellectual, physical, and spiritual. And when these levels conspire in absolute unity, there's a connection that I believe is a version of God. We human beings crave this sense of completion, connection. The non-mystics perhaps call it being in the zone, and perhaps others see it as a divine communion. Well, I do. One of the great joys in my life is to include my audiences, who are in fact my friends, known and as yet unknown, in the experience of being complete through music. There's a magic when you play a piece of fine music with intention. Without words, another person understands and resonates with the message. It's miraculous. Day 2. Actually, I live in 3 worlds. World 1, the world of the dark, sequestered recording studio and editing suite and the concert platform, all womb-like, self-contained universes in which sound and its personality reign supreme. It's a world of magic, of manipulation of musical images, of emotional transparency through sound, and sometimes of electronic manipulation. Vibration rules. When you look at the word vibrate, in fact, it comes from the same stem as the word to live. World 2, my quotidian world, which is increasingly overtaken by the demands of cyberspace, pressure, lack of time, expectation that I will consecrate my entire being at all times to being available, to sharing myself with the community that lives inside a computer. I resent this. The other subset of this quotidian world is the Jane that is a mother, fairy godmother, keeper of the house, supermarket trawler, baker, daughter, reluctant financial and musical administrator, passionate practical flute swot, painter, sculptor, poet, environmentalist, and friend to many. World 3, the natural world. I go down to my local beach and plunge headfirst into the nacreous, delicious seawater. It's exactly the right temperature for my taste. I swim along the ocean bed, watching grains of sand, waving in time to the water's lullaby. I feel my lungs compressed by the pressure of the sea. I feel connected looking at the grains of sand. It reminds me that every atom came from a star, and we're all made of stardust. Is there an equivalent star for every grain of sand? Is there a star for everyone who was ever born? I wonder, will scientists one day discover the correlation between the multiple dimensions of space and the multiplicity found in one human character? Will the Big Bang be scientifically and directly linked to the human orgasm? Perhaps the whole universe is caught inside each body. As I float along, I suspect that none of these thoughts are original, but thinking about them makes me feel connected. The ocean is my other mother, in fact. We all come from the sea, and I think of Arthur C. Clarke's science fiction story with its amphibians crawling out of their ocean in A Journey to Earth. I also think of Anais Nin. Day 3, from Anais Nin's House of Incest. My first vision of the earth was in water veils. I am of the race of men and women who see all things through this curtain of the sea, and my eyes are the color of water. I looked with chameleon eyes upon the changing face of the world, looked with an anonymous vision upon my uncompleted self. I remember my first birth in water all around me, a sulphurous transparency, and my bones move as if made of rubber. I sway and float, stand on boneless toes, listening for distant sounds, sounds beyond the reach of human eyes, born full of memories of the bells of the Atlantide, always listening for lost sounds and searching for lost covers, standing forever on the threshold like one troubled with memories and walking with a swimming stride. I cut the air with wide, slicing fins and swim through wall-less rooms. I loved the ease and the blindness. The water was there to bear one like a giant bosom. I moved within color and music. I felt only the caress of moving, moving into the body of another, absorbed and lost within the flesh of another, lulled by the rhythm of the water, the slow palpitation of the senses, the movement of silk. Loving without knowingness, moving without effort in the soft current of water and desire, breathing in an ecstasy of dissolution, I awoke at dawn, thrown up on a rock. For me, that is how it feels to be inside the spirit of a musician in this world.
Jane, that monastic kind of discipline that you mentioned, being a musician, you must have recognized pretty early in life those hours of practicing. Do you enjoy solitude?
Oh, that's a mixed question for me. I enjoy the solitude required to play music because there's that being in the zone, absolutely focused in mind, body, spirit on what you're producing, this wonderful sort of consecration to sound. I really love that. It makes me balanced. I think I'm very social. I love people. As Bette Midler said, I love people. They're my species. I'm a bit like that. And so it's...
So what's it like having all those hours and hours and hours of practicing?
I don't feel alone when I'm playing my flute because it's just so... It's such a feeling of completion. I'm so grateful to the style of flute playing that I learned. I learned with Jean-Pierre Ampal and Alain Marion. They really taught me how to have a perfect balance between mind, body, intellect, emotion, spirit.
And so when you're with your flute, you're not alone.
I'm not alone. And I think at an early age, I was a real all-rounder at school. You know, I sort of turned my hand rather well to a lot of things. And around the age of 13, I realized that classical music and fine music had enough complexity in it to really hold my attention probably for the rest of my life, and it's still thus. I mean, I'm so passionate about many different things, but music I know can really, it's just got me at a very integral point and has held me there.
Well, very early in your spiritual diary, you offer a definition of God or a version of God. It's a sense of wholeness, emotional, intellectual, physical, spiritual. When did you come to that realization?
In verbalizing it, probably about 10 years ago. But I suspect that when I went to Paris and I started to really understand the discipline that I was being taught, this French style of flute playing, I think that I realized that that actually is what I was working for, to have a sense of absolute completion when I was playing music. And I think when younger players come to me for advice, I really try to encourage this sense that they're not just a sound-making machine, but that they're actually consecrating their whole being to something which is a hidden language.
I'm not surprised that as a musician you defined your life as if it were a kind of three-part harmony: the music, the quotidian day-to-day, and nature. But I get the feeling that it's your music and nature which feed your soul and which give you the strength to do the quotidian day-to-day.
That's so true. I mean, I don't know anyone who's just not feeling overwhelmed these days by the expectations that are placed on us. It's too much. I think we're all just, it's like we're on the most incredible treadmill. And I've discovered recently we Australians work more hours than many people of many other nations. Music and nature, I think we're all born with this sort of what I call divine homesickness, this longing to be back in some sort of Neptunian form where we're reconnected with, I don't know, it's an otherness. I don't exactly know how to define it in words. I can define it more easily when I play my flute.
But gosh, you must know many musicians around the world who don't have that easy and ready kind of communion with nature that you do.
Possibly not, but I think the ones who are really good musicians find it within their music. So I'm just doubly lucky to be an Aussie and to have been brought up with really great parents who encouraged me on an intellectual level, but constantly exposed me to beautiful things and to nature. And, you know, I'm not afraid of being in nature. I'm not scared of spiders. I don't, you know, all that stuff. I have this sense of being part of it. And I think many Aussie kids, and I think we grow up with an expectation that we do belong in that world.
This is Jane Rutter's Spiritual Diary on the Spirit of Things.
Day 4, I escape from the studio and I go to the nearest rainforest. With the bush as my entourage, I can close my eyes and breathe in the damp earth. It evokes a primeval memory. I belong to this scent and it belongs to me. It's my favourite smell in the whole world. I open my eyes and if I look very carefully, I can see the molecules in the air, breathing. I can see movement. The air is dense and full of colour. It breathes of its own accord. If I listen with great attention, I can hear two threnodies humming inside my body. One is undoubtedly my nervous system. It's a high-pitched sound, a bit like the sound that comes from a neon light, only higher. The other is deeper and darker. It's my blood moving through my body, accompanied by distant tom-toms, my pulse beating and my heart beating. Music is within all of us. That's the song, the breath of life. Structured fine music is another reminder of our connection to nature, science, and life. Day 5. I can't contribute to this diary without talking about a course I did several years ago. Landmark education is essentially an inquiry into language and the way in which we form our strengths, our upsets, and our personalities around language. I'm a much more balanced and reasonable person having received this type of education. These days, when I hear something about myself that I don't like, I'm able to watch my ego reacting to this. It's been particularly useful as a parent, and I don't necessarily nowadays think that my ego is me. I now believe that me, i.e. my character, the person that I am, is defined by that which inspires me. Here's an exercise. Ask yourself this. On your deathbed, as you look back at your life, how do you want to feel about yourself? What judgments would you pass upon yourself? Now, ask yourself the question. How would I have to behave now in order to be that person looking back at my life? I found that the answer to who I am lives in the response to this question. I'm sure that this will come up for me over the next few weeks in the diary. Day 6. I've been reading the meditations of Marcus Aurelius with admiration. So much of what he says incorporates the way I want to live my life, with discipline and devotion. I was taught to play expansively with passion and abandon in the musical phrasing, so emotional control over my inner life has not until recently been a priority. Seek that which is interesting, find beauty in trouble, and tell all their stories through music. That's been my credo. Only recently have I valued peace for itself and for myself. The tempestuous has charmed me up until now. It still does, in a way. It stands on the sandy shores and blows its beckoning, commanding conch shell for me. And I, well, I'm obedient, serpentine. I do an about-face and crash through the waves towards it, looking for heightened passion. Unfortunately, sometimes it's spilled into my intimate relationships. Now, I want roller coasters of emotion only in my music and in tropical rainstorms. I don't want it very often in the rest of my life. What I want is peace. I knew it so well as a child, and I've taken it for granted and only valued it of late.
What about your parents and your spirituality that you have developed over the years? What kind of input did they have in your spiritual life?
My father was an absolute atheist, very scientific, you know, great scientific mathematical mind. I mean, just before he died, I told him that I thought I probably did believe in some sort of afterlife. I defined it in the sense of us being made up of atoms which go elsewhere once they're not consecrated to keeping our bodies together. Those, 400 trillion atoms. My father was really shocked when I said I thought there was something else after this. My mother's mystical. I think she's become quite religious in a way, in her own free, liberal way, as she's got older. And so I was very exposed to all sorts of different faiths. So I've sort of learnt bits and pieces about different faiths through osmosis. And my parents were very open-minded about beliefs and philosophy. And I actually view spiritual disciplines more as a philosophy to be drawn from than something that's containing and that that is something, you know, that would straitjacket you in any way.
Jane, musicians, particularly gifted ones like you, can find the prosaic world of relationships rather challenging. Is that because making music is a constant inward search and discipline, which by definition is self-serving? And I don't mean that in a yeah. nasty way, but in a way that you are the instrument of music, so you are always nurturing your ability to convey that music.
I think also that's sort of a two-pronged answer to that question. On one level, if it's about being selfishly devoted to one's music, the people that I've been involved with haven't really minded about that at all. In the sense that we musicians are constantly striving to better our last performance. We're striving for an abstract ideal, which we're never actually going to reach. It's a very dangerous thing to bring to a relationship. I mean, my 12-year-old son said to me, "Mum, you know, when you're in love with somebody and you're in a relationship, do you think that you analyze it in the same way you analyze music? You try and better it, and you're constantly trying to make it perfect." And he said, "You know, Mum, that could drive people crazy." And it was very insightful of him. And
he was only 12 then.
He was 12. And I think artists and musicians, we do have a tendency to sort of deconstruct what we've just made and you know, step back from it and go, "Oh, I could have played this note better," or "This is how I defined it." Instead of saying the relationship is complete, it's defined, stop talking about it, get on with it. So that's a tendency, it's dangerous.
These are the forgeries of jealousy, and never since the middle summer's spring met we on hill, in dale, forest or mead, by paved fountain or by rushy brook, or in beechen margent of the sea, to dance our ringlets to the whistling wind.
Day 7. In order to save my flute-playing arms from RSI, I'm writing this with a speech recognition dictation machine attached to my computer. Each day, when I say the day and its number, my computer deigns to spell it D-E-I, which is the plural of God in Latin. For me, it's no mistake that the word pan means God and implies everything. I'm part scientist, part mystic. I love to read New Scientist. My father and I used to spend many long hours discussing its contents and the implications of such expansive scientific imagination and learning. I miss my dad so much. Currently, scientists are desperately searching the theory of everything. We, as musicians, are seeking to prove this through the medium of sound. We strive for perfection, for connection with everything, with an all-being through the sound. Day 8. I don't think that many people know that a halo is in fact in the form of a figure 8. It's really an infinity sign constantly circling around on itself. So much of life is turning. The spirals of the DNA, the planet turning on its axis. The planet's turning around the sun. The spirals in a sunflower, in a shell, in snowflakes. My dear friend, the late Dion Cilento, made a wonderful film called Turning, which is all about this. It leads us to the whirling dervishes of the Sufi faith in Turkey. The whirling dervishes repeat their ecstatic dance, the zikr, as they turn. They empty their hearts of all but the thought of God, and they whirl in the ecstatic movement of his breath. Day 9. I'm thinking of jealousy and possession. My album Titania's Dream is a modern-day look at magic, adultery, deceit, marriage, genetic mutation, the ecological state when the spirit worlds are warring, and the differences between the male and female psyche. There are parallels with the current wars between Christian and Muslim, between fundamentalism and liberal spiritual practice, which embraces scientific truth. Day 10. How do we foster imagination in our children in a world that is so dominated by electronics and the visual? Is there room for imagination? How do we ensure its survival? It's easy to think that cyber world has replaced inner world for many of our children and teenagers. And having seen some of the games that my son plays, it can be very, very beautiful in there. There's now a disorder called nature deficit disorder. Day 11. Ish kala mabud ala. God is love, lover, and beloved, a Sufi axiom. A church, a temple, or a Kaaba stone, Quran or Bible or martyr's bone, all these and more my heart can tolerate, since my religion now is love alone. Day 12. Apparently there are spiritual glands, and I've done some meditations on them. In the Sufi tradition, they are called latifs. It's important to keep these spiritual glands opened and breathing. In the latif meditation, it's possible to infuse these spiritual glands with energized color. They have specific positions in the body and specific sayings or mantras to accompany them. I haven't done this meditation for a long time. The last time was at Karnak in Far North Queensland with Diane. Somewhere in the back of my brain, I know this meditation and I want to start to do it again. It's so lovely. I wish everyone was shown these sorts of insights. I'm very lucky.
That's Jane Rutter, Australia's most versatile flautist, and she's letting you into her world via her spiritual diary, which she's kept for the Spirit of Things. I'm Rachel Kahn, and I invite you to start a spiritual diary of your own. Upload your thoughts or music or artwork onto the special My Spiritual Diary page on Pool, ABC's social website.
And actually, of all instruments, I think breath instruments are the most near us, like voices. Because it has that nearness to the heart, nearness to the breath, nearness to everything that lives. It is the breath.
Your great friend, the late Diane Cilento, who's been on The Spirit of Things, by the way, talking about Sufism, did she actually introduce you to Sufi prayer and Sufism?
She did, and I suppose in a way, I don't know if I'm a delinquent Sufi or not. I suppose I'm following in some ways the Sufi path and in some ways the paths of other religions and in some ways not. I did a 12-day meditation course with Diane, but with Diane, she was such a lover of life and so extraordinarily creative that the meditation course involved picking fruit trees and dancing and all sorts of, you know, wonderfully mad things. There was almost a sense, I partly felt that I was in a Nancy Mitford novel being in Diane's company. There was this sort of organized pandemonium where everything was thrown up into the air and then it would come down.
Has Sufism stayed with you?
Yes. Diane was the first one who showed me the poems of Rumi. And the Sufis have this belief that the flute represents the human body, which is being played upon by the breath of God. And so this whole idea of vibration and resonance and purpose in life, it does actually really appeal to me. Day 13. I have many difficult days, and on some of these days my mood is known in our family as the dreads. When I get the dreads, nothing's right, and I collapse circles of hopelessness and despair in on top of each other. At the time, I feel as if I will never bob back to the surface. And usually the thing that makes me feel better is talking to a friend, playing my music, or helping someone far less fortunate or in a more miserable state than I. Helping people makes me feel really happy. I've been so busy working on an Australian in Paris, dealing with a nasty legal case, grieving my late father, and dealing with the unexpected death of two very close friends, and being mostly a single mother, concert soloist, self-promoter, etc., etc. I'm not complaining, but I've been working 17-hour days, 7 days a week. I've been fairly antisocial, and not by choice. Well, today I rang an old friend who's so peeved with me that he hasn't heard from me and that I haven't invited him over. I can't bear the thought of hurting anybody. My family thinks this is a fault of mine, that I let myself open to being taken advantage of. But, you know, I'd prefer to remain open to everything than to shut anything down, to be less feeling, to be available less emotionally. Anyway, I apologize to my friend. and I open up my old other friend, Marcus Aurelius. And in book 1.13, he says the following words. Catullus, the Stoic, counseled me never to make light of a friend's rebuke, even when unreasonable, but to do my best to restore myself to his good graces, to speak out bravely in commendation of my instructors. Day 14. The Balinese believe that the world is sitting on the back of a giant turtle. Perhaps the universe is like the never-ending worlds which are found in the last book of the Narnia Chronicles, a world within a world within a world, and so forth. Size is completely irrelevant. Day 15. Laugh out loud. I have for 7 years, along with my best friend, referred to myself and the friend, most lovingly, as an idiot. I don't know, it feels endearing for both of us. This morning, I was reading up on some of the characters mentioned in An Australian in Paris, my new DVD and concert theatre piece about my life as a student in Paris. It appears that many of my favourite women of the Left Bank were also called women of the rope by their teacher and mentor, George Gurdjieff, a character about whom I have mixed feelings. However, and this is such fun, I've just discovered today his Science of Idiocy. It's really made my day. I knew it. We are all idiots, and God is the supreme idiot. Day 16. Om, I am, : the truth and the way. I've often thought there is a colon missing in one of the great teachings of Jesus Christ and the Hindu faith and other faiths. If you strip away all the roles created by your ego and personality, the answer to the question, who are you, becomes a series of roles which you take seriously in various and varying degrees. But at the absolute foundation, the answer to the question is simply, I am. And this is the truth and the way for everybody.
You have a fiendish wild streak in you. That's probably why you quoted Gurdjieff.
Oh, my God, I know I do.
Who said that God is an idiot. However, I think that that sort of external, it really contrasts to the confidence and the strength that you have inwardly.
I don't mean to offend anybody by quoting Gurdjieff, God is an idiot. If you read up on it, there's more of an explanation about it.
But when you talked about I am the truth and the way.
Well, I think people think that Jesus was saying, only look to me. You know, you must follow me. And I don't think that's what he meant. I think what he meant was look within. I really believe that there's a kernel of divine in all of us, and that what inspires us, that's who we truly are. It doesn't have to be a daily meditation. It can just be, look, I'm in a place of upset because my friend told me he didn't like my behavior or whatever it is. Oh, this shouldn't be like this. No, look within and go, is that really what inspires me?
So does God reside inside you, or is there a God out there in the cosmos? Or is God, as Soren Kierkegaard said, a deeper immersion into existence?
Well, I think the latter. For me, if it were going to be whatever it is, God is, different manifestations for different people, I believe that we're absolutely, I mean, when I say we're all made up of stardust, yes, we really are. I mean, I'm not being romantic about that. We come from stars. And so we belong to everything. And we all have this, I called it divine homesickness. We do have a really innate need for reconciliation with that sense of belonging to everything. For me, music conveys that, and so hence the connection on all the different human levels. Day 17. I learnt so many meditations from my friend Diane Cilento. One of them is, light a candle. Close your eyes, breathe deeply, and turn yourself inwards. Imagine the sun sitting in that place between your ribcage. Ignite all of your body with the sun's rays from within. Feel it, ignite it. Each time you think about it, draw energy from the area where the sun is living inside your body. To finish, feel every part of your body fully ignited by the sun within. Feel yourself humming and throbbing with the warm energy and stellar power provided you by the sun.
As a mother of a teenage boy, you're in the position of giving spiritual guidance to him. How do you do that?
I've tried to show my son beautiful things throughout his life. It's much easier to talk to them when they're little. I really encourage him to be in nature. It's a very difficult time when someone's 16 and forming their own personalities, by necessity they push away from their parents. My son's a beautiful boy. He's affectionate and intelligent and musical. And at the moment, I am insisting that he reads certain books. But I also think teenagers really need to have their own sense of space. There's not much space in the world. I get scared for our teenagers and our children just because of the amount of time they spend in cyberspace. And I try to fight against this with my son.
Would you ever bring him into a meditation and put him into a meditational space?
I've done this often with him as a child. He knows how to meditate. He goes into a reverie when he hears beautiful music, and I'm not pushing that now because I don't want to be, I mean, it's like that Looney cartoon. I think all parents will recognize this. I feel often when I'm talking to my son, it's like talking to the dog, blah, blah, blah. You know, when you say, okay, Ginger, you've had it, blah, blah, blah. But the dog actually hears blah, 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 Ginger, blah, 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 blah. So, you know, teenagers these days, so many young people seem to be ignorant and proud of it. And I said to my son recently, you really need to study. You need to know things. I want you to know the classics. I want you to know religions and mythology. And my son said, but, you know, all I need to do is just look something up on the internet if I need to know something. And I said, yes, but the thing is, you know what you know. Like, you know that you know how to play the guitar. And you know what you know that you don't yet know how to fly a helicopter, for example. But you don't know what you don't know, and that's where education and study comes in, because how can you look something up on the internet if you don't even know about it? You're not going to just stumble upon it. Well, you might if you're lucky. That's my argument.
Jane Rutter, mother, mystic, and medium of music. She's the flautist who also composes and creates musical projects like her most recent DVD, An Australian in Paris. Being in midlife, she's looked back on those formative years in Paris where she honed her art. And you can catch some video excerpts on the Spirit of Things website.
Day 18. Stage fright. So what are we afraid of? The only authentic fear for humans is death or physical danger. The rest is just a story. I don't know. A spider bit me when I was 8, so I invent a story that will never happen again. Oh, I mustn't go on bushwalks, so I will never be bitten again, etc. Who taught me to be how I am? What moments shaped this inauthentic fear in me? Day 19. The 99 names of God. One day, at Karnak, the rainforest sanctuary in far north Queensland, created by my great friend and sometime mentor, Dian Cialento, I awoke to sound, very early. Birds and animals chanting, waterfalls dancing, noises everywhere, the limpid songs of the rainforest, all nearly eclipsed by a musical sort of bellowing which was coming from the lake. Later in the day, at the convivial communal breakfasts, and these breakfasts were held daily at the Ritz, an old Queenslander painted citrus yellow with an enormous wraparound veranda, generous meditation room painted in rich royal dark blue, with mystical ornaments, mandalas, Sufi poetry on its walls, a huge kitchen and quaint bedrooms all open to the elements via the veranda, which is pregnant with bookshelves and works of art. Anyway, Dion Cilento asked me if I'd slept well. I replied yes, that I'd had a delicious sleep, but I was perplexed by a sound which had very early awoken me and which seemed to be coming from the lake. "Oh, that was just me shouting the 99 names of God," said Dion. In the Sufi tradition, everyone is born with a particular spiritual name whose properties represent a way of being in the world. All have access to these 99 ways of being, but there is one dominant name for each person, and this name indicates your true purpose in the world. I love this idea. My name is Rafia, the one who praises life through beauty.
You say music is in all of us, and I think you're right, but for some, it lies buried. Do you delight in awakening it in the most unsuspecting people?
Oh, yes, it's so wonderful. I mean, my teachers in France gave me this. You know, Alain Marion said to me, "You know, I play something and you keep it in your heart. You'll have it in your heart forever." He said this to young children and all his students. I often move people to tears when I perform, and I know they're tears of emotion and joy. That's very gratifying. I think music, and I say this to young players who come to me for guidance and lessons, it's very important work that we musicians do. We keep the emotional portals open. When we play with musical honesty, it does miraculously open up something in others, in the people who are listening. They sort of go, "Oh yes, thank God, it's a reminder from some otherness that we all have that is not necessarily defined by words." I really love this about music.
Well, your search for a muse and also for a great teacher and mentor took you to Paris, and Jean-Pierre Rampal in particular, the greatest flutist at the time, certainly. What did he give you that no one else could?
Well, actually, I really had two teachers in France. Alain Marion, who was like Jean-Pierre Rampal's spiritual and flutistic brother. They worked together. Rampal was an inspirational star of the flute. He was an incredible person. I had some lessons with him and I was in his company a lot. Alain Marion was more the true brilliant teacher who really molded his students, who said, deconstructed everything and said, "Listen, this is the technique with which you attain your goal."
So technique, but what did Rampal give you?
Jean-Pierre Rampal gave a love of communication and the voice, the joy in singing, that there is an absolute innate joy in all of us to be alive, and that you could put everything in life into the flute, that it's not just about being locked away in a music studio or in a concert platform and producing the notes and being technically perfect. It's about being technically absolutely as perfect as you possibly can, and then opening your heart and just singing almost without ego. There are many flute players who are wonderful, who I listen to them and in an intrinsic sense I hear their ego in the music more than I hear the true essence of the being. And this is what I'm not fighting, but I'm making a strong statement with an Australian in Paris about: this is the thing that moves people. It's this pure, sort of unstraitjacketed, unbridled emotional honesty which is required in music, I think, to really move people. Day 19. Often in my first words to an audience, I recite a poem by Rumi. Listen to the reed forlorn, crying ever since it was torn from its rushy bed. A song of love and pain. The secret of my song, though near, none can see and none can hear. Oh, for a friend to know the sign and mingle all his tears with mine. 'Tis the flame of love that fired me. 'Tis the flame of love inspired me. Would you learn why lovers bleed? Then listen, listen to the reed. The flute is the reed upon which the breath of God plays music. Day 20, Humour. Along with Marcus Aurelius, Jane Austen, Colette, Stephen Hawking, Joan Sutherland and others, Bette Midler, the performer, is a hero of mine. Although she's bawdy and can be profane where I am not, in that moment between a surprised shock and the subsequent laughter of a joke, at that point where humans are laughing, the emotional portals open and one can, metaphorically speaking, say or imply to an audience, "Ah, now I've got you. Now, you listen to this." Then, in this moment, when they're open, they're ready to be moved in more serious ways. As well as fine music, humour, you know, when we can laugh at ourselves, that reminds us of the best of what it means to be human. Day 21. Scientists believe that space-time is curved and that we end up where we start. In music, when you're performing on stage, time is completely transformed. One bar can seem like a lifetime. An entire movement can pass by fleetingly. I can never explain this, how time stretches with music. Day 22. The death of the voice. The main purpose of my life to date has been to communicate through my flute joy in living, to perpetuate the notion that we are all born with an innate ability to create, that it's our birthright to be creative, all of us. So many of our young people today are ignorant and proud of it. I daily work against this. I've spent much of the last 7 years working on a project which defines the love affair that Paris has had with lyricism, and it also describes my life as a student studying in Paris. How do you play love? How do you play fear, tenderness, exasperation, pride in music? Ask me to take a musical phrase and I will play it with various emotions, the same notes. I know how to do this. Because of what I call the new fundamentalism, it's perhaps no longer as valid or valued amongst young flute players and young musicians. I think about this with sadness. In An Australian in Paris, my flute speaks with the Jean-Pierre Rampal-inspired musical style of Parisian classical flutists. Its voice also describes the revolutionary theatrical styles of the Parisian demi-monde, stars such as Josephine Baker, Edith Piaf, Colette, Nijinsky and Charles Aznavour, to name a few. The Rampal school has philosophical connections with Jean-Jacques Rousseau, Chopin, Bizet and Offenbach, and personal links to Debussy, Ravel, the French Impressionists, Stravinsky, Poulenc, Messiaen and many others. I feel so honoured to help keep its legacy alive. Day 23. I've decreed in the last year to devote as much time as I can to saving the world's oceans, which is no small job. Our oceans are literally choking in plastic waste. As I've become increasingly aware of this, I'm also increasingly appalled at how intelligent people who say they care about the environment can be so careless about the use of disposable plastic. It drives me nuts. I've begun to amass a group of people to perform concerts worldwide in order to raise funds for various marine science institutes and to encourage the absolute no-brainer for everyone in the Western world to give up one piece of disposable plastic a day. It is so easy to do so. I really wish everyone would. I believe change can happen. I remain enthusiastic about humankind. I'm devoted to this request and to my music.
Jane, you're about to release a film called An Australian in Paris, which you've been working very hard on for some years. What compelled you? What was the compelling motive to make this film? What do you want to communicate with this film?
I've always loved the works of Colette, the French writer, and she writes in a very stream of consciousness kind of way and connects everything in nature, and but she's very worldly. And I found, almost by chance, a self-portrait that I had written at the age of 19 when I was living in Paris. And that sort of was like a call to action. It was it refreshed my memory of the experience of living in Paris as a young woman, of having these two incredible flute teachers who actually became not mine, but everyone's guru, everyone who studied with them. We were all shown how to live, how to be joyful in music, how to convey that, how to be communicative. And so I really felt compelled to, at this stage in my life, share that with not just other musicians, but with a general audience, to remind people about what it is to communicate and be absolutely immersed in this sense of complete connection.
Jane, what have you learned from keeping your spiritual diary?
I suppose it's been definitional for me. Again, things that I knew about myself, but to have them all down on the page has been really interesting. I'm tempted to keep going with it. And actually, I might, if I get the time, I might join you've got a website or a blog, so that would be fun. Reminding myself of meditations that I haven't done for years. Just also, I think when you put into words what defines you, it's actually that is who I am. And so that's been really great too. And it's been, well, what better thing than a reminder to self about the things you value in yourself? So I really thank you for that, Rachel.
Well, I want to thank you because you're not only a wonderful communicator on the flute, but you're also deeply poetic and wonderfully rich in your sharing of your inner world with us. So thank you. And I wonder whether you might just pick up that flute over there and give us a little bit of what you might have put into your spiritual diary if you could have recorded it.
I haven't played today, so this is for those flute players who are listening. You don't always need to warm up.
Jane Rutter picking up her flute in the studio and just playing the beginning of Debussy's Prelude to the Afternoon of a Faun. Well, what a montage of music, poetry, art, nature, Sufism, science, and motherhood coming together in Jane Rutter's spiritual diary. I hope you got a lot out of that, because it's such a privilege to be let inside the personal spiritual space of a brilliantly creative artist-musician as Jane Rutter. And doesn't she speak Franglais so beautifully? It's as convincing as her French. You can download the audio or just listen online at the Spirit of Things website, where you can also find the details of all the music and watch a couple of excerpts from Jane Rutter's An Australian in Paris, a new ABC DVD release. This week, production was by me and Jeff Wood and Manny Vosserstrom.